Our mission is to bring you an unbiased discussion on the technological development and application of unmanned aerial systems in our airspace. UAS Today.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Michael Garrity. In today's podcast, I went to Vanilla Aircraft, where I interviewed Jeremy Novara and Neil Bortland. Jeremy has worked in the unmanned aerial system industry for the past 8 years as an integration and test engineer, as well as a composite technician. Currently, at Vanilla Aircraft, Jeremy leads the areas of flight operations, business development, and finances. Jeremy is a private pilot, has flight time on FAA-certified unmanned aerial systems in the national airspace. Jeremy also holds a degree in economics from the University of California, Davis. Neil has over 9 years direct experience in unmanned aerial system design and test, with a particular focus in systems engineering, modeling and simulation, wind tunnel testing, and propulsion. At Vanilla Aircraft, Neil serves as the project engineer for the VA-001 aircraft. Neil received a Bachelor's of Science in Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering and a Master's of Engineering in Mechanical Engineering from Cornell University. What were you guys doing prior to starting your company?
Well, Neil, myself, and Daniel all had careers prior to this in the unmanned aircraft industry. We've worked for various companies, both on the East Coast and, in the case of Daniel, he worked on manned aircraft on the West Coast. I think our careers were fairly short before starting Vanilla Aircraft, but our careers were fairly dense. I think, fortunately, between the three of us, we at one point had participated in all aspects of an aircraft design company. So not just the design, test, manufacture, flight, but we had visibility to the programmatics, the accounting, the business side, the business development side, and some of the legal framework.
What was your motivation to really getting into the unmanned aerial system industry, and what drove you to start your own company?
So one of the things that got me excited about the unmanned aircraft industry, even before starting Vanilla, was kind of unlike in manned aircraft, the scales of the teams who design and build unmanned aircraft, they can be quite large, but often tend to be smaller. And that was something that was really appealing to me as an engineer, that I could, you know, work on a small team where you really got to see all aspects of the design, and it was comparatively short time scales to, again, where you could, in the course of a couple of years, follow something from, you know, your sketch pad into production. And that's just not something that, you know, you're seeing these days in the manned aircraft world. And so as an engineer interested in aerospace, you know, the unmanned aircraft industry just had this great appeal. In that you could have that sort of breadth and depth of experience, and just sort of the speed at which the engineering and the development was happening just so far passes, you know, what I was seeing as available in the manned aircraft industry. So that was how I got really, you know, into the unmanned aircraft industry as an engineer. So as for Vanilla, we worked on a variety of projects, and we sort of, you know, for various reasons decided we kind of wanted to work on different stuff than what we were working on, and decided kind of to go off on our own to even become, I guess, sort of a smaller, tighter engineering team that working at a company of, you know, 100 or so people was already, you know, kind of at a point where we were getting frustrated with the sort of corporate inertia that it could have, and how hard it could be to even through that size organization push new ideas out there.
I agree with Neil. For Daniel and I know that we were aircraft guys first, not necessarily unmanned aircraft guys, but you look at Boeing and Lockheed and you can see engineers that spend their whole careers on one airframe these days, whereas we were fortunate enough to have been able to work on a dozen different aircraft projects, at least, certainly between the three of us, in our relatively short careers so far. And you become a better engineer when you can close the loop from design, build, and test. You can see what your assumptions were and what you ended up with, and you can improve your design ability for the next round because you've seen the results and you know what works and what doesn't. And we think it's hard to get that if, at best, you've only gotten to work on one project.
you're working for these various companies designing, and you basically want to move on to different things. What made you choose unmanned aircrafts? Was it a late night conversation around a table, or was there something in particular that really? See, you're smiling over there, so I know this is going to be a good one. There might have been some martinis involved. See right there. This is drinking breeds innovation and creation. You guys decide that you want to form your own company. So, what made you choose unmanned aerial systems?
Well, we did see a market opportunity for our particular aircraft that we ended up designing, and our excitement wasn't over that it was unmanned so much as it was an aircraft that would be able to do something new, but on a smaller, more affordable, accessible scale than some larger aircraft out there. So we saw a way that you could keep a small payload either in orbit or sent very far away for a comparatively affordable cost compared to current systems. And I think that we were a bit altruistic when we were doing that too. We didn't set out to design a vehicle for the Department of Defense, and although we could obviously see how they would find that useful, but we also saw use in this for NASA, for the commercial space. So, but mostly it was we were excited about the idea ourselves. That was the most important part.
Like we said before, you know, this was already an industry that we were kind of working in. And so, you know, so it was sort of natural that we were thinking about, you know, this industry and kind of where the gaps were. And that kind of, you know, led us to the VA-001 product that we are working on. And, you know, we've worked on some other things along the way, but that really was kind of, you know, it was a while before we started actually, you know, doing designing and engineering of it, but this sort of idea that, you know, we could see that there was a lot of interest in long range, long endurance aircraft, and that there was a lot of work being done on those, but either at a very large scale or with solar power, which, you know, can result in very expensive airplanes. And we really saw that there was a particular gap at the smaller range. That's where range and endurance was particularly lacking, and it was also, you know, where we thought we could most easily make a difference. You know, we're a small company. We're not going to, as a first product, be, you know, like, we could design a better Global Hawk. You know, it just wouldn't be feasible. So that was sort of how we ended up kind of working on what we're working on.
Neil mentioned, you know, we have worked on other things as a company over the last few years, but the real reason for forming the company was the VA-001 product. We didn't set out to form a UAV company and then sit around thinking, okay, now what do we do? We saw this product as a real discriminator and something that we were able to, would be able to achieve. And, you know, that is what made us, that's what let us take that leap. I don't think that any of us wanted a company for the sake of having a company. But we had a product, and we needed a company to make that product, and we thought it would make us successful.
So. Tell me a little bit about your initial aircraft that you guys have designed. You called it the VA-001.
I think as we'll talk about a bit later, we saw a real push in the market space for longer range and endurance unmanned aircraft, but a lot of this was happening on a very large scale. You think of your large Global Hawks. There were some large aircraft being done by some other companies, and, you know, 737 wingspan large, right? So we really wanted to kind of bring that capability into the small UAS realm. And we weren't sure how small, but we started looking at various options, mostly around propulsion. And we ended up with something that looks like a small sailplane, a little smaller than a manned sailplane. And it launches into the air like a sailplane, but it has a pusher propeller on the back of it. Instead of carrying a person, we carry mostly fuel. We still carry a payload in the nose, but we...
Could you be a little bit more specific on what you're saying when you say payload?
Well, we say around here that we are payload agnostic. So a lot of customers will come to us and tell us what they want the payload to be. And for, I'd say for the most part, we are not talking about a camera ball that hangs off the bottom, but different types of radars, LIDARs, communications equipment, scientific payloads, either for particle sensing or gas sensing, payloads of that type. So we've ended up with an aircraft that carries a lot of fuel and carries what we feel is a useful or standard payload for this size aircraft. And from that, we get a lot of range and endurance. So we're talking up to 10 days of endurance at about 70 knots. airspeed, which is, one could say, 10 times longer than what most small UAS are doing right now. And again, there are some much, much larger aircraft that are claiming multiple days of endurance. Nothing quite like this. Obviously, there's other technologies out there like balloons or solar aircraft. So we feel like we found the right balance between affordability or cost, availability of the technology or the subsystem technologies, and utility in the sense that unlike a balloon or a very lightweight aircraft, we can actually move around. We're not affected by winds. We can go high, we can go low, that sort of thing.
What is the max altitude that your aircraft would be able to operate at?
We intend to operate anywhere from fairly close to the ground, depending on the maturity of the autopilot system, to up to 20,000 feet, which is still considered a medium altitude aircraft.
So you had your product or your aircraft that you wanted to use. What led you to choose the customer that you would potentially market to?
I guess part of how we determined, you know, the customer to... So our initial customer for this airplane was NASA, and particularly NASA Earth Science, and based on their interest in doing Antarctic ice elevation mapping, that they have satellites that they can measure how the thickness of the ice varies from year to year, but they also want another means to sort of make the same measurements, both to fill in some years where they'll have a gap in the satellite coverage, and also just to provide a secondary means of verifying their data. And so that was kind of where they had an interest in a small but very long-range aircraft, because Antarctica is large and far away. The way we ended up with them as a customer is we obviously recognize commercial applications this potentially has, but we needed more R&D money than we had ourselves. And so we needed to find a customer that, you know, could provide some of that research and development money. And really right now, you know, outside of private equity, that is the government. And that's also, you know, one of the easier customers in general to start fielding a system with, because of all the FAA regulations and export controls, is the U.S. government. So kind of with those constraints, it made sense to look at U.S. government customers as our initial customers, and NASA seemed to just be a good fit, and it was a mission that we were excited about, and that also helps.
We didn't set out to do it, but we almost by chance ended up submitting proposals to the SBIR program, and it's the SBIR program within NASA that where we got our research funding. I think that was lucky for us. We didn't know that we should be pursuing the SBIR program. It wasn't our plan to, but the program allows us to keep rights to our technology versus if the government paid you in just research and development dollars, they would own exclusive rights to the technology that was developed. So it's good for entrepreneurs. There really is no program like it anywhere else in the world. And it's a lot of money that's out there. If you have something new, you have to do a little bit of groundwork. You have to talk to the principal investigators that are within the various departments that have the program. But it's a large source of money, and almost second only to venture capital in the United States. So I know a lot of companies, I've seen a lot of bad technology come out of it, or useless technology, but I've also seen some good programs. So I think they have the same approach as VC. For every X number of SBIR programs we award, hopefully this many make it big, and they earn their money back through tax dollars as a result of this successful new technology. So
your company has been in business for the past 5 years, and you've definitely had some setbacks and you've had some move forwards, and it's exciting. You're getting ready to head out to New Mexico to one of the 6 established test sites set up by the FAA. Is that correct?
Actually, no, it's not one of the 6 congressionally mandated test sites that the FAA recently set up. Each of those have tailored research goals that they're supposed to explore using unmanned aircraft to help facilitate FAA integration. New Mexico State University is actually the original established FAA test site. New Mexico State University for a while now has had a COA in place with the FAA, and they are allowed to do their own flight review and flight test of aircraft with a obviously still with FAA approval.
So you're getting ready to head out to New Mexico. Talk to me about the process that's going through with that and how you came to get permission to go out to that to test your aircraft.
Well, we have a large and long-range aircraft, so we wanted to be judicious in where we conducted first test flights. We didn't want to conduct first test flights over water or over populated areas. We're pretty conservative with our approach. The desert is a natural place to be testing aircraft. We originally were trying to coordinate with NASA use of restricted airspace for flight test. Instead, we will be going to New Mexico and flying under their COA with the FAA.
Will the university be taking part in this test flight with you?
The university leads a flight assessment of the airframe, and then they take their findings to the FAA, which has 30 days to either make an approval or not. Once there is an airframe approval, we will work with the university on a test plan. In this case, this is a first-of-type test plan. So really, first flight for us is quite limited in scope, considering the capability of aircraft, but demonstrate launch and recovery, demonstrate stable flight, demonstrate that the autopilot works. Some pretty basic things, but they're big questions when you have a new aircraft. So there's a lot of work to be done leading up to that flight review. We have to show all of our engineering data, all of our test data. It's a large effort. We're going to pack up our aircraft, not just our aircraft. We have to bring most of our shop and all of our people. Basically, vanilla aircraft will move to New Mexico for hopefully no more than a few weeks as we set up the aircraft out there, do some local range testing, and then conduct the flight test. Well, you know, we've scheduled a window of time. Hopefully, we'll take the first available flight day, but we're planning the trip such that we're not rushed at any one point. The last thing you want is be rushed right before a flight test.
Okay, so you guys are headed out to New Mexico, hopefully relatively soon here, once you're getting your final approval and you get out there. What are some of the concerns that you have that you'll be facing when you get out there?
And obviously you go into flight testing, doing your best to have tested everything you can test and having written contingencies for, you know, what if the generator stops working or what if you lose link and all the known contingencies. But there's always, you know, things that crop up in flight testing that you weren't expecting and that will probably end up, you know, coming back from first flight and having to scratch our heads over for a while before we go on to a second flight. That's just sort of the nature of flight testing and why you go out and do it.
I certainly wish you guys luck with this, and I hope everything goes well while you're out there. As part of the interview, we let our listeners know who we're going to be having on the show, and we give them the opportunity to write in and get the chance to have their questions answered by the people that we're interviewing. So if you guys don't mind, I brought a couple of questions with me today from some of our listeners who'd really like to have you answer them, if you don't mind.
That'd be great.
Okay. So our first question comes from Jason, who's from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he asks, do you have any plans to take your company to an international market where regulations and FAA restrictions don't exist or are less restricted?
We don't have any immediate plans for export of the aircraft, mostly because right now we're focusing on first flight and proving it out. There may be challenges given that there's been government research funding put into this that would complicate export. Again, these are things that we'll be addressing in the future. But the relevant issues are, you generally come down to ITAR, which is the International Traffic in Arms Regulations. I stuttered because I wasn't sure I had the acronym right. International Traffic in Arms Regulations, I believe. And also the Missile Technology Control Regime. So I also think that there's a lot of press about the U.S. falling behind the rest of the world in some UAS applications. And I frankly believe that that is true. But that doesn't mean that it's a free reign anywhere you go in the world. I think there are places that export would allow us to fly that might not be available to us right now, but generally we're still talking about probably remote locations or over international waters. But we have an aircraft of such a size that it's not like we would be able to fly over Paris if we were allowed to fly in France. It's more we would be interested in flying over the Arctic if we were in Canada or the desert if we were in Chile. So we're sticking with the plan now of the domestic product, but we be keeping our ear to the rail to see how these things develop.
Okay. Our next question comes from Brittany, who's from San Francisco, and she asks, what markets for UAS technology have you considered?
Well, I think we talked a little bit about the fact that there's export concerns, and we've definitely talked about the challenges of getting access to commercial markets. So from the very beginning, we had the understanding that the main customer available to us was the U.S. government. So there's still a lot of variability there inside the U.S. government. Obviously, everything is dominated by what happens in the Department of Defense, but that doesn't mean that NASA, NOAA, the Department of Homeland Security, even the Forest Service are out looking at and actually using an unmanned aircraft. So we still see a lot of opportunity in all those, what I would call civil applications. So within those customers, we've seen more payloads and more missions almost than I can recount right now. I'd say almost everything under the sun. And I think that we take most interest in the things that really cannot be done on another aircraft right now. So if someone wants a camera and they want to film take hyperspectral imagery of a field, in our minds, you know, that could be done on a 172 still. Whether or not it's cost effective, you could do some analysis and you can figure out at what point is your aircraft cost effective over others. But really, in order to differentiate ourselves, we're trying to look for missions that can't be done by any other aircraft right now. So that's why we were talking about flying over Antarctica for extended periods of time with a LIDAR, or flying over the ocean, taking either, the deep ocean, like middle of the Gulf Stream, doing diurnal ocean color imaging or extended particle transport sampling. So, and again, I struggle just describing some of these missions because, I mean, the scientists will come in and they get excited. Wow, there's new science that we can be doing here. There's new capabilities that we could have. And I think that's where we're really trying to focus, because that's what's going to differentiate our aircraft from others. And later on, once we get some maturity on the system, then we can look at some of the, what you call the dull and the dirty work that can be done on existing unmanned and manned aircraft, but hopefully with our range and endurance, we could have a cost advantage over those. But that'll come in time.
Our next question comes from Kevin, who lives in Phoenix, Arizona. Kevin asks, what responsibilities do you see unmanned aerial system companies having to the public?
Well, I think, of course, you have to say that their responsibility is first and foremost to operate their aircraft in a safe and responsible manner. And as a private pilot, that's certainly important to me. I think in the near term, helping show the positive impacts that unmanned aircraft can have for the public benefit is both important to the public and important to them. Countering some of the bad that you see in the news today with some good aspects that unmanned aircraft can provide, helping people in all manner of ways. So this is one of the reasons I wanted to do this interview today. Just put out factual information and let people decide for themselves whether this is something they want or don't want.
Our next question comes actually from two people who asked a similar question. Scott and Mindy, both from Indiana, asked, where do you see unmanned aerial systems in 5 years, commercially, domestically, internationally? Where do you see it going?
Well, I think that domestically, commercially, it's going to be really in the next 5 years that we're going to start seeing more widespread use of the aircraft. There's a little now, there's a lot of buzz about the FAA rulemaking and whatnot. But it's my personal opinion that a real solution for domestic commercial applications is going to be tied to the implementation of the next gen system with the FAA, including the ADS-B system. So that's good. That has to be implemented by 2020. I think that will be an important step. Until then, you're just going to see increasing but limited, almost trial of medium to large size aircraft. I do think that small UAS will have an easier time being integrated into the airspace just because of the lower risk that they pose to the other users. But and on the other hand, the very large aircraft like Global Hawks will continue to operate above most of the users in the airspace and within the restricted airspace available to them through military bases. So I think the medium aircraft are in a sticky spot domestically. Internationally, I think that use of medium-sized aircraft is going to continue to increase at a large rate. We've mentioned a few times the questions surrounding export rules and regulations, so see how that one goes as well. However, domestically, in terms of civil use, I think that is where the market will be. I think that there are a lot of agencies that are gaining more experience with unmanned aircraft, and they're starting to utilize it. I know that NOAA is expanding its research into hurricanes, and NASA is revamping its UAS flight review process to hopefully incorporate more flights on their end. I think the Homeland Security has had some troubles in the past, but they're still trying to get back in line and utilize UAS more effectively than they have been. And what I mean by saying that is we can't rely on setting up temporary flight restrictions to fly unmanned aircraft over. It might be acceptable to do that over a forest fire, and I think that's normal procedure, but you can't have a standing restricted airspace over the border or a port where you want security. You need to have those aircraft integrated, and they're definitely working towards that integration. And they're going, unlike commercial partners, they're going to be able to do that because of their status as a public entity.
Our next question, our last question, will come from AJ from College Station, Texas. And this one, I think actually we should have moved to the beginning of the conversation. AJ asked, how did you come up with your name?
So the name Vanilla Aircraft came about from our background and the sort of projects that we were working on prior to forming the company, and kind of where we wanted to kind of take our careers in a different direction. Before forming Vanilla, I worked on some pretty crazy aircraft, vertical takeoff, hybrid electric sort of things, cruise missile engines, and it's kind of exciting, very exciting as an engineer, kind of pushing the boundaries of technologies in all directions at once. But when you kind of push the boundary of technology in all directions at once, it ends up being kind of science-y. You know, you don't, it's not necessarily a great way to develop products. And that kind of became ultimately frustrating, and why we sort of decided to create this company, that we wanted it to be very product focused. And we thought the right approach to doing that was to kind of do simple things, to take existing technologies, combine them in different ways, but do things that were kind of ultimately simple, but do them very well. And that's kind of where the name Vanilla came from, that we're not trying to stretch the laws of physics. We're combining sort of proven sailplane aerodynamics with proven sort of propulsion systems and other things that at in their separate spaces are very well proven, and bring those together to create this new unprecedented technology. And that was kind of what Vanilla Aircraft meant to us, how we came up with the name.
Well, gentlemen, I really want to thank you both for being on our podcast today, and I want to wish you the best of luck with your upcoming test flight out in New Mexico. We really hope that everything goes well for you, and when you come back, we'd love to have you on the show for you to tell us how things went. So again, thank you so much for being on the show.
Absolutely, thank you, and we'll definitely keep you posted.
Oh yeah, thanks for coming, and we love talking about what we're doing, so we'll let you know how it goes.
That's about all the time we have today for our podcast. Our guests today have been Jeremy Novara and Neil Bortland from Vanilla Aircraft. For more information on Vanilla Aircraft, I invite you to check out their website at www.vanillaaircraft.com. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed on our podcast are those of the authors, producers, and our guests. They do not automatically reflect the views or opinions of any organization or government agency that are guests on our podcast, nor do they reflect the official policy or position of any U.S. government agency. If you have information that you would like to have discussed on our show or would like to be a guest on our show, please contact us on our website, uas-today.com, or email us at podcast@uas-today.com. Thanks for listening.